Iris Dement, and this is Chris, and the show is Peace and Justice, and I'm pleased to be with you today in these trying times. I honor this ability to be able to be on KZFR, to be your host today for an incredible show. We're going to start off with Reverend Rebecca Senoglu. She does a show called The Wheel, which has been on KZFR for 2 years now, but only on the fifth Thursday of every month, so only four times a year. The Wheel is a show that considers the mysteries of living and dying and is a local voice in the international movement to bring death out of the closet. Rebecca Senoglu considers the mysteries of living, dying, loving, grieving, and honoring our dead, and she will be interviewing safe space activist Sienna Sonoki, who is going to be talking about the exposure deaths of homeless people in Chico. And as you know, Safe Space, I think you know this, some of you do anyway, Safe Space wasn't able to operate our regular winter shelter that we've had for the last 6 years due to the COVID and concerns that churches have had and some regulations about sprinklers in these places. But they have been providing shelter for over 100 people who have been referred to as something called Project Room Key, which has kept people, high-risk people with underlying health conditions, safe through the pandemic in local motels. If people need shelter, they can call 211, and as things keep changing, keep trying there, there may be some solutions forthcoming. Our conservative city council has, at their last meeting, talked about the fact that these sprinkler requirements, which kept us from getting a very large shelter early in the season, which would have met the needs of so many people that are currently unhoused at that time. I don't know who is at fault, city staff perhaps, but anyway, they didn't realize, I assume, that that they were able to have waivers from the building codes that required sprinklers, and even though there was an emergency shelter crisis even at the time. However, now apparently ducks are in the row for the city to work with nonprofits on a strategy and finding a property to be approved. This does not help the situation of people in the parks, and it does not move quickly, probably. So continue to work and advocate for the unhoused. These nights are cold, these nights are wet, and more people will no doubt die this winter. So keeping pressure on your city council people is important, and you can reach them at chico.ca.us/city-council.directory, and you can get the emails for our city council people there. And also letters to the editor are a good idea, but keep this issue in front of people, because there is a real and urgent need not to criminalize the homeless for doing what they were directed to do at the beginning of the COVID crisis, which was to shelter in place. And they are now very confused and very alarmed and very, very much in the crosshairs of Chico Police and the City Council, which is ran on a ticket of getting people off of the greenways and out of the parks. So that is my take on all of that. And there's much more to talk about, but right now, let's get right to the interview that Rebecca did with Sienna, okay? Hang on here.
Sienna Sonoki last Sunday, January 3rd. As many of us are wondering what we can do to respond to the surprising number of deaths of unsheltered people in our community, Sienna and I talked about her experiences of death with the homeless, about the new mural she has created to remember them, and about how Chico Friends Meeting, the Quakers, where I'm a member, has responded to having an unsheltered neighbor die on our porch. Here's the interview.
Hi, thank you for having me. I play a couple of different roles in the community. One of them is with an organization called Safe Space Winter Shelter, and I've been volunteering with them for several years as a shelter operations manager every winter when we open up the shelter, and then now I'm also a board member. But in general, I also do street outreach and have been one of the people that goes out into encampments and speaks with folks and tries to help advocate to get folks housing and services that they want or are looking for.
I know that you are a go-to person, Sianna, and I just want to thank you for that. Our community really, really benefits from all that you do. You didn't mention, I think you've also been the powerhouse behind the mural on the outside north wall of the 1078 gallery. And can you tell us a little bit about how this mural came to be? What was the vision?
Okay, so I am an artist also. I think an artist first and foremost, actually. And I love painting murals. And I've been wanting to paint one for some time. And at the same time, there are so many people that die in the community that are without housing that are not memorialized or remembered. And often there's not even like a ceremony or a moment where people are remembered. So I really wanted to make a mural that had their names on it. I mean, it's as simple as it could be, and kind of a message to them that, and the community, that you're not forgotten and you are truly loved, because the reality is that they are. And 1078 was looking for people to paint murals on the outside of their building. And then also a person I was really close with died in July out at Tykert Pond, and he was homeless. And I kind of just felt like this natural pull of like, okay, now we're going to do the mural I was thinking about, because I can't process James's death in any other way.
Yeah, what touches me about what you said is about how they are loved. And I think for those of us who volunteered for Safe Space, that's a feeling that does develop, and it becomes personal. I think, you know, for many in our community, the image of the homeless is pretty vague and impersonal. But for those of us who have volunteered, and for you, as much as you are out there, you get to know these people. And once you get to know them, it's a personal loss when they die. So yeah. I wonder if you would like to tell us a story, or more than one story, about your experience with the death of your unsheltered clients.
Sure. I feel too like what I've learned over time is that the love isn't only coming from, you know, people that are housed, that are doing, you know, quote unquote charity work. There is so much love and so much caring practice among people who live on the margins of society with each other, that it's really a great learning experience to see that level of love between each of them toward each other. And that's been something I feel like, at becoming so personal with some of the folks that live on the street, it's been a real gift to me to be able to experience and see that level of compassion and care for each other. That often I think when people are very far away from homeless folks and don't interact with them very much, they can very much think that like that kind of love doesn't exist there, and that these people are unloved and abandoned, disposable people in society. But when you get down into the communities, you see just how there are such beautiful relationships, and it's been really a gift to see. But to your question, I think over time there have been many deaths, and some I have had personal relationships and some I have just admired from afar or known from afar or not, you know, not interacted with very much. But still I can feel their loss in the community, because everybody else is feeling that loss. And I think when someone dies that is not memorialized. Like, it just starts to spread throughout the homeless community. Like, what are our lives worth if we aren't even, like, doing anything for this person that died? And I think in the beginning, there was, like, when I first started working with folks on the street, I was a little bit, like, shocked by people dying. And then there was a period of time where I felt kind of numb to it because it just happened so often.
When you say it happens so often, do you want to give us an idea of how many people have died recently?
Well, I don't have an exact number, but I feel like there's been close to 20 who've died in 2020. Not all of them have died out in the street. Some have died in the hospital. And in the last 3 weeks, 3 people have died on the Chico streets, just in the last 3 weeks. We are also running a program called Project Room Key. In this program, basically, it's non-congregate sheltering, so people are in motel rooms. And when the program started, we got as many people in as we possibly could. All of them are meet a medical criteria to come in or are 65 years and older. Within the first few months, like 6 or 7 people died. And it was really shocking. There was a person named Bear, who was a native man from Grindstone, who was very soft-spoken and very sweet, who came in, and he came into the motel program, but he had already been referred to hospice months before he came into the motel program. But hospice, he had some kind of cancer. Hospice couldn't really work with him while he was on the street. It didn't work well for his situation. So he came into the motel program, and that's when his body really started to deteriorate, and we wanted hospice to get involved. So we worked with the True North Housing Alliance to get an apartment for him, because the hospice agreed to get involved if we could get him an apartment, which we did. And then we were basically on shift, sitting with him and being with him while he was dying. I went over one day to kind of visit one of the people that were caretaking for him, and he died in front of us. And I think for me, that was probably one of the most up close experiences that I've had with death in my entire life. Like, I've dealt with a lot of loss, but like, this was actually watching it. And so we could feel his body go from being warm to being cold. And we sat there with him for 4 to 5 hours while his daughter came, and then then the coroner came. And it was just a really intense experience. And that is only one of the deaths that's happened in 2020. So, you know, I think that I don't even know how to process things like that. It's just kind of something that attaches to you, I think. And that's where I'm at with it, if that makes any sense.
I work at the Cancer Center, and it's just so hard to manage care for people who don't have an address. And I just feel like when people are facing the end of their lives, they deserve that. Mother Teresa is an excellent example of that, right? That, you know, people deserve compassion and care when they're facing the end of their lives, no matter what their circumstances.
I think that when Bear died, it's really struck something with me, in the sense that I felt like his process was he was able to be calm and comfortable when he died, to an extent. And I've heard this a lot from people that have been a part of the end of people's lives. But, you know, maybe it was 2 years prior, I knew a man named Vance. A lot of people knew him. And he died a very terrible death of cancer in an alley between 13th and 14th Street by Park Avenue in Chico. The jaw cancer or the face cancer that he had completely eroded his face to the point where you could smell it, and he could not, you know, it started where he couldn't hold a cigarette, because he couldn't smoke it because there, you know, he had to cover up parts of the wound to be able to create suction, to the point where he couldn't eat. And all of this happened in an alley in Chico. And his friends stayed with him until he died. They all did hospice with him eventually. I mean, they stayed with him every night, and they grieved when he was gone, and they took care of him until he died. But that to me felt very different than what I saw with Bear, because with Bear there was a softness to the way that he died. And with Vance there was like a fight, and it was hard and painful. And I wasn't in the room when Bear had kind of lost reality, but there was a point where he was talking about all of the things in his life, and, you know, he wasn't quite conscious, but he was mumbling things about rivers he'd seen when he was young and different things. And I don't know that that process could have happened if he was on the street, because there's no space to soften.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I wonder if you think people that you serve are more familiar with death than the average housed American.
A lot of people I've talked to were familiar with death before they became homeless. And sometimes the death is like a big trauma that led to whatever life situation they came into later. I can think of so many people who I've talked to about how they became homeless, and a lot of it had to do with losing someone they love, or someone that they maybe shared a home with, their mother dying, their grandmother dying, somebody that took care of them. Especially when you are talking about people that have very severe mental illness, that have a hard time taking care of themselves, and when their support system passes away and there's no one left, and it's the only person that loved them or that they felt that they trusted, you know, that can be a huge trauma. Yes, being homeless, there are some very practical, real reasons why people die more often, you know, when they're unsheltered. It's just a reality of living in the elements, of the lack of safety, of, you know, all sorts of things. But I'm also always interested in when I talk to people about how much they talk about not being afraid to die. And that feels like a bold statement sometimes from someone, and I'm always like, what do you know, you know? But then when I sit and think about it, I'm thinking particularly about a certain person who was very close with Eric Euler that just passed away. And he was very close with two other people that just passed away recently. And he's like, I'm not afraid to die. And when I think about his life experience and what he's been through, which is mountains more than I have experienced, like, he actually might not be afraid to die. And not everybody that's homeless is like this, but, you know, there are certain people that talk just about, like, they're living their lives in the moment the best that they can, and they're not afraid to go.
Yeah, it's such a different reality that that creates that acceptance, perhaps, or that lack of fear. Wow, I hadn't thought about that before. Sianna, I was amazed when I called the Butte County Coroner's Office, and they don't have a system for tracking the deaths of people who don't have homes. I realize now it's not an easy question. Can you talk a little bit about what you know about these deaths and why it's difficult to pinpoint, oh, this was a homeless person who died?
Right. There is the death in a public right of way, which would mean if a human body was found in a public area, which one was just found yesterday near 1 mile, that would be counted as a death in a public right of way, and we could count those. They aren't always people that are homeless, of course, but often they are, and we could count those. But there are also, you know, people that are living on shelters that are in and out of the hospital constantly. So people are dying in the hospital. And if somebody dies in the hospital, you know, you'd have to get that data from the hospital on whether they had an address or not. And you might even have to peel into that a little bit more to find out if that address was just a mailing address or an accurate address. I also think there's this interesting phenomenon, and actually, to tell you the truth, I've read about it for other providers that are running Project Roomkey. There's this kind of phenomenon where they're dying once they're getting sheltered. And it's terrible to say, and it feels strange saying that, but it's happening. And to me, it almost feels like when people are outside, the adrenaline is so high, there is constant survival mode and constant operating on level 10 anxiety and very little sleep, that it's almost like the body's on survival mode. And then when the person comes inside and those defenses and those modes start to relax, the other illnesses are starting to take over the body. I'm no doctor. I don't know if this is a real thing, but this is what it feels like is happening.
What do you know about how much COVID is responsible for these deaths in terms of people actually having COVID? I mean, obviously, the circumstances have created some interesting things. Yeah.
As far as I know, the deaths that I've seen so far have not been COVID-related. That doesn't mean people haven't been exposed or have a positive COVID test. In our motel program, we're getting referrals through the county from people that are COVID positive or a confirmed exposure but have nowhere to isolate. They're coming to the motel for short-term stays, and we've had about 130 of those people coming in for short-term stays. So COVID's definitely, you know, part of this population as much as anyone else. A little harder to isolate when you don't have a house or access to running water in a bathroom. But as far as I know, the deaths haven't seemed to have been COVID-related.
You know, we talked a little bit about memorializing. Let's go back there. You've created a public place to memorialize the homeless who are dying. Have you seen the unsheltered community memorialize and mourn their dead in other ways? I'd be curious to, you mentioned earlier that sometimes nothing happens and there's zero, but I know there have been other examples, and James is what's coming to mind because I've ridden down the bike path, maybe that you would want to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, definitely people do their best to process in whatever way they can. I've definitely seen, you know, kind of makeshift memorials of people putting, like, flowers or something at a spot. I've seen people write on walls. I have known of groups just getting together to remember someone. And so it definitely happens. I think that also the survival of trying to meet your basic needs all of the time and stay out of a place of feeling pain, particularly with folks that have addiction issues, you know, that can always be about finding relief from pain. One thing that I see so much is people processing their grief through laughter and humor and trying to have a good time and just trying to feel good, you know, because it's so hard all of the time.
Oh.
And we have to remember too that so many people, some of this comes down to possessions. Like if you're homeless and you want to hold on to a memory of someone that's a physical thing, that's actually really hard to do. And I think that's just another thing that is related to all of this, like to not being able to process, you know, when your items are taken all the time or you don't actually have access to things.
That's something that we take for granted, is the ability to have our mementos. I'm going to mention a little bit about Eric. I'm a Quaker at Chico Friends meeting, and one of the things that prompted this conversation with you, Sianna, is that Eric Euler died on our porch at the meeting house at 16th and Hemlock. And it definitely made this conversation very personal for us at the meeting. And we sat with it, talked about it, prayed about it. How do we respond to this? And we were surprised about how invisible it was. Eric's death was not mentioned in the news. So we've created a memorial on our fence on 16th Street, and it's an invitation for people to come to bring a ribbon or some sort of memento and attach it to the frame And there's a big picture of Eric there, and just our, you know, putting it out there that we are holding this in the light. We want this to be seen and known, and our heart goes out to all of the people who are living and dying unsheltered in our community.
Yeah, you're right on target there with that. I mean, Eric was with us when we painted the homeless mural, because that was his neighborhood that he was around all the time. So he stayed with, for one full day, he sat while we painted that mural. And he was telling us names to put on there, reminded me of certain names that needed to be up there, told me about names that I hadn't known.
Well, thank you for bringing some of that to light. And thank you for sharing with us your experiences and making it all more real for us, not just the dying of our unsheltered neighbors, but their lives. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to be with me today. Do you have any parting thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with?
I don't know. There's so much. But, you know, I think going down to the mural and checking it out and reading all the names would be really interesting for people to do. We are getting emails and messages to add more names from family members, and I think that's just really interesting that it means a lot to people outside of even who's in my orbit. You know, it would be great if people went down to check it out and take a moment to occupy some of their brain space with the names of people that have passed that don't often get recognized.
Yes. Yours is a permanent memorial. Ours will be up probably about a month, and so people are invited to go down and tie a remembrance of some sort to that also. During this winter when we don't have safe space and things are very, very hard for our unsheltered neighbors. Thank you so much,
yeah, thank
Deanna.
You so much.
I appreciate it.
And I appreciate it, too, and I hope all you listeners do, too. That was Rebecca Santaglu and Sienna Sonicki in conversation about the death of local homeless people. And it will be archived on the KZFR website. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And also we want to thank Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when it's available at the Thursday Night Market and the Saturday Farmers Market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org, and you can also find them on Facebook. It is 1201. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'd like to thank a few more underwriters before we go on to our next segment. I'd like to thank Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. And they have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farmstar Pizza at 2359 The Esplanade at farmstarpizza.com and on Facebook. The telephone number to order is 343-2056. And also Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980. Reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. Okay, so I'm going to get our next guest on the line, and let's do a song. Peace to you all.
In my head, I want my fellow man.
And this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice, and we're on with you every Friday with rotating hosts. It is my honor right now to begin an interview with Laura Levitt. She is a professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University, where she has chaired the religious department and directed both the Jewish studies and the gender, sexuality, and women's studies programs. Dr. Levitt is the author of The Objects That Remain, the book we'll be talking about today, which was published this November at Penn State University Press. She's also written American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust, Jews and Feminists, The Ambivalent Search for Home, also co-edited Impossible Images, Contemporary Art After the Holocaust, and also co-edited Judaism Since Gender. I'd like to welcome you, Laura Levitt, to the Peace and Justice Program.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Sure. And I kind of struggled with how to introduce your story because it is a painful and personal one, but I'm just going to say what happened, and you can, we're going to talk about it, but it just might be easier to cut to the chase and say these things. On a November evening in 1989, our guest, Laura, was raped in her own bed. Her landlord heard the assault taking place and called 911, but the police arrived too late to apprehend Laura's attacker. When they left, investigators took items with them, a pair of sweatpants, the bedclothes, and a rape exam was performed at the hospital. However, this evidence was never processed, and of course, Laura did not know that. Decades later, she returned to these objects, viewing them not as clues that will lead to the identification of her assailant, but rather as a means of engaging traumatic legacies writ large. And I really appreciate this book because it taught me a lot about things I wasn't aware of, about trauma, about evidence collection, and about the Holocaust Museum and the sacred objects there. So thank you, Dr. Laura Levitt, for this book, The Objects That Remain.
Thank you. That's a really wonderful kind of overview of the book, and I appreciate your careful reading.
Yeah. Well, you know, what it's hard for some people to understand is the process that trauma victims go through after a crime, after a brutal crime. You were living in Atlanta at the time, and you write about going on with your life, about just almost euphoria you had about being alive, and you were a scholar, a teacher, a writer. You were in a relationship with a potter. You were pretty much a happy person, and you got through this with just some dreams, perhaps nightmares, but after your mom's death, this is when things started to unravel, and you started to come back and circle back to what had happened to you. Can you talk a little bit about your timeline? I know you started the book in 2008, but you didn't really find out what had happened to your evidence until quite a bit later. Can you talk about your timeline?
Absolutely. So, yes, I began the book quite early on. This was a very long process. And in part, I think I was had some trepidation about actually contacting the Atlanta police and finding out what, if anything, had happened with the evidence in my case. I had very, very low expectations. And in fact, I think I had imagined early on that there would be a final chapter of the book, basically entitled something like Nothing Remains. And so I was preparing myself for the worst, which is something that I write about as well in the book. But over time, I kind of built up the courage by coming to this topic in a way that may seem kind of from the very far end of things. I didn't begin with my evidence. I began by trying to think about and learn about what happens to material objects that are taken into police custody. So I had learned about another woman's case, a case of, unfortunately, a brutal murder, and how belatedly the evidence in that case reemerged in the courtroom over 30 years after this woman had been murdered. And hearing about her clothing is really what set me on this journey. I was surprised and kind of startled because I care about clothing, and I hadn't thought about anything that had been taken from my apartment that night that I was raped. And this was in the very beginning, almost 15 years after I had been raped. And then I decided that I wanted to learn what the police do. I also had been thinking through some of these issues because I had worked on Holocaust memory. I was working on a book, American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust, which looks at photographs in particular as objects that that remain, particularly family photographs from before the war that that camp prisoners brought with them into the concentration camps. And so I started by wanting to know, well, what do the police do with evidence? And so I began by doing research and learning about how this was not a legal question, but in the process of discovering that, I learned that there was a professional organization that was trying to, you know, sort of raise the professional standards of what happens in police property rooms. And I was fortunate to meet the president of that organization and eventually become a member, an associate member, and take one of their courses. So I began by learning what police do with material objects in custody, and then I kind of turned to what conservators and staff at the Holocaust Memorial Museum and their archive do with the material objects in their care. And then I was able to use that knowledge to come back around and engage with the work of two beautiful writers who had written about their experiences or their family members' experiences of terrible trauma. And that was the poet Maggie Nelson, whose aunt was murdered, and she wrote a book of poems called Jane, a Murder, and eventually a memoir called The Red Parts about this belated trial in her aunt's case. And I read that book alongside a very beautiful Holocaust memoir about a family story by Edmund Duvall called The Hair with Amber Eyes. And that was an incredible family story told through the objects in this once very wealthy family's collection. And so in the process of doing those things, I only slowly got back to my own story by really leaning heavily on reading these other beautiful writers who taught me how I could kind of tell my story otherwise. And they gave me the courage, I think, to go back and to contact the Atlanta police in 2014 to find out what happened to my evidence.
Right. And, you know, you covered a lot of territory right there for parts of the book in terms of encapsulating it, but you wrote about the return of property as a form of justice. You said writing helps contain brokenness and can make it beautiful. There are containers for the brokenness. It reminds us of the passage of time. Objects hold the promise of finding something of ourselves, and we find ourselves also in the narrative of others. And as you went forward in this, you said that the search for evidence, the actually working on that chapter about searching for evidence and all the incredible focus that you made in terms of learning about how police store evidence was actually the easiest chapter to write. And so can you talk a little bit about criminal holdings? Because if there are victims listening, I want them to understand about rape kits and the Violence Against Women Act and what does it look like out there? Who are these people who are holding the evidence? Who is responsible for them? And how are they valued or not?
Well, I think you're getting at something that's really important, and I think that for any of your listeners who have experienced this kind of violation, I want them to understand that although we assume that the law does, that criminal justice officials do these things, that once, you know, you submit to a rape exam, which is a very invasive procedure, that something will be done with it. I mean, we kind of do this with the hope that that DNA evidence will be collected in a data bank so that if there are other folks who've been victimized, that we can kind of track serial rapists. And I think in my case, I'm sure that the man who assaulted me had assaulted other women and probably continued to do so. And that was really important to me in terms of going to the police and submitting to a rape exam. But what happens is all of these things are taken into police custody. And those of us who are familiar with TV shows about criminal justice, they don't have that CSI fancy equipment in every office. These are really diffuse collections all across the country in precincts. What happens is most of the time the police professional who is in charge of the evidence room or the evidence locker is not someone who was necessarily trained to do that. And if you think about a show like The Wire, sometimes what happens is, you know, somebody gets into trouble and they put them in the evidence room so that they, you know, are not out on the street. And so it's not a valued piece of the legal system, despite the fact, and this is a thing that I wanted to emphasize, that without that evidence, there are no criminal cases. This is both a supplement and an essential piece of the criminal justice system. We think about the chain of custody in terms of the law, so the provenance, who gets what, where, and how, and then it goes into custody as if that's an end point. But custody is an ongoing practice, because in order for that DNA material to be viable, to be used in court, to be able to get information from it, it has to be kept in a temperature-controlled space. It has to be kept in the right kind of container, because without any of that, it won't be viable and it won't be valuable. In addition to that, the people who are running those rooms need to know how to find the stuff, so they have to kind of be both custodians on the one hand, and very good ones at that, and they also have to be kind of like librarians. They need to be able to know where they put the case files or the material objects so that they can gather them when and if they ever need to gather and bring them to court. And that's a lofty set of practices. And what we've discovered over the last number of years is, despite, I think, a great many good intentions and the focus on DNA, the fact of the matter is that still thousands and thousands of rape kits across the country have never been processed. And I know that there's been federal legislation and there have been private efforts to try to get so many of these kits processed, but it's expensive. It has to go to a criminal lab. It has to be taken care of. It can cost up to $500 or more dollars to do this. And so there is this terrible backlog. And so the sadness that I have around this is that this is impeding a system that may already not be particularly robust in relation to sexual assault to begin with.
Yeah, and for me, what was so dynamic in this was comparing it to evidence collection at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which you describe as a repository of memory. It's an archive of Holocaust evidence. It is there to confront hatred, prevent genocide, and promote human dignity by the engagement with the artifacts of that period. And you were very interested in collecting, conserving, and cataloging what happens. So can you talk about the Holocaust Museum and the care that's taken with the victims' belongings?
Absolutely. It's really quite a remarkable feat that they have been able to accomplish, because in the case of the Holocaust Museum, this is still criminal evidence, although it will never go to court. And so I wanted to think about, you know, what it means to hold those materials. And they are there for the public, which is somewhat different than what happens in the criminal justice system, because you can't have people tampering with criminal evidence, right? It has to be locked away. But as an archive, the museum in Washington has this remarkable collection of material objects, many of those that they collected in Europe. And in the last number of years, many survivors have given the museum their precious objects, objects that they held on to as survivors, and they've told those stories. And what the museum does is these are professionals who are trained in art conservation and curation, in archival research methods and library methods. And what they have done is they've worked very carefully. In art history, sometimes we, or in art museums, we think about restoration, right? But because the objects are so valuable for the Holocaust collection, because they were witness to these horrific crimes, they are themselves very, very fragile. They are tainted objects. They are, you know, bullet-ridden cloaks or a diary that was handmade by a partisan in the woods that has all kinds of dirt and, I'll use the Yiddish term, schmutz on it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's those pieces, those elements that that make it not, you know, pristine, that are of so much value. And so the conservators at the Holocaust Museum work very, very carefully to both try to date and authenticate the objects that they have in their collection. But as the chief conservator told me, you know, she would do her damnedest to make sure that she respected the integrity of the object. So she didn't want to take large swaths of a child sweater or that notebook to test it, right? She'd like to do her work with minimal additional damage because of the frailty of the objects that are held. And so they work very, very carefully to make sure that they're temperature controlled, that they're light controlled. For example, there are these remarkable wedding dresses that were made out of parachutes at the end of the war in the DP camps. And parachutes were made at the time out of nylon, which was a very new fabric, and it was not meant to last. So it is very sensitive to touch and also sensitive to light. And so at the museum, they've created very careful boxes that are kind of the shape of that those dresses so that they can hang carefully within them without being further damaged.
Yeah. Yeah, there was so much in that chapter, and that's the book we're talking about here is The Objects That Remain by Dr. Laura Levitt. And we are running out of time. We have 3 minutes left, and I want to get, if there are any victims there, I want them to hear this next part, because this is, I think, really important. Is the rape occurred November of 89. You did a records release in a records, looked for records in 2014, and then you found out that your case had gone inactive 2 months after the rape, after all of this, and that everything had been lost. Your clothing, your bed sheets, and the rape kit, everything was gone. And so you spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about justice, retribution, and the idea of the sacred, how to regain the sacred, how to regain the sense of wonder through relics and rituals. And I was wondering if the rest of the time you could address those things.
Yeah, there are many things there. Mm-hmm. I think that doing justice is about recognition and acknowledgement and being seen and heard. And I think that we are done a disservice by the kind of police shows that we watch on television and legal shows where we think everything is resolved in a courtroom. And I think that the power of being recognized and heard and acknowledged is underrated, and it's very powerful and important for those of us who've been violated. And I think that that's really, really important. And the ways in which we think about these tainted objects, I want to remember that they were there with us at that time, in that place, and they're here now. And they help us remember that this really happened, and they are, in some sense, silent witnesses. And as such, they have a special role to play. They're not just criminal evidence. They have qualities that are beyond that, and that's why I think about the language of relics. And I think about the tender care as a kind of ritual of holding and preserving these painted pieces of evidence, because they are reminders and powerful reminders of that which we live with. Those of us who have experienced trauma and loss, it doesn't just go away. We continue to tell our stories, and we continue to live on. And there is a euphoria about being able to continue to be alive that was incredibly powerful and important for me. And I don't speak for all survivors, but I want to recognize that it can also be just incredibly lonely. And my hope is that the ways in which books like Maggie Nelson's and Edmund Duvall's spoke to me so powerfully and so compellingly, they really offered me companionship. And companionship is what I hope my book might bring to others who live with awful memory.
Yes. Yes, and the book is The Objects That Remain, and you can find it online and can have our local bookshops order it for you, too, which helps them during COVID. And Dr. Leavitt, I'd like you to have the last word about this. I know we just skipped through this so quickly, and I'm sorry about that. What else would you like to tell our listeners in this particular time?
Well, I'd like to just say that I hope that the book speaks to a broad public. And again, I really am committed to this idea that we can do justice by telling our stories and sharing them with others, and that sharing is an act of doing justice, that kind of acknowledgement that I talked about, that I think is so powerful and meaningful and compelling. And I would like your listeners to know that, and that we do live on. I think sometimes people just say, oh, people are victims, and they don't understand that living with traumatic memory is an ongoing process, but that in that we can also have tremendous joy.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today, and I hope people will check out this book, The Objects That Remain, by Dr. Laura Leavitt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris, for your careful reading. I so appreciated talking to you and to your listeners.
All right. Peace to you, please. Bye.
Peace to you. Bye-bye.
All right. I want to remind our listeners that there is a John McCutcheon concert coming up on Saturday, and this is a partial benefit for KZFR. You'll hear the forward promotes for it here on the station. I want to go on with our next interview as quickly as possible because there's so much, as always, going on in our community that I wanted to be able to cover it. And there's a lot of information in the book that we just talked about, The Objects That Remain. I would highly recommend it if you know anyone who is in police work. This section on evidence is very, very important for all of us who might be crime victims. It needs to be much, much better curated with the kind of love and care that the Holocaust Museum evidence is. And so thank you to Dr. Laura Leavitt for coming on the show today. And let's move on then. And here's some music. And I'm not sure what I have queued up, but I know it's fabulous. So here we go.
Walk with a purpose through the parking lot. Keys in your knuckles, 'cause you ain't got claws. Remembering when your daddy taught you that boys will be boys, gotta watch your back. Sitting there drinking at the bar alone. Sharks come circle, wanna take you home. You better not play coy, better not be me. Boys will be boys, and they are fragile things. And they got names for the ones who talk back and the ones who wear those clothes. They got names for the ones who say yes, the ones who say no. Hey, baby, why you gotta be that way? Give us a smile, you got a pretty face. And there are things you do and things you can't. Live quiet as a mouse in a room full of elephants. Or don't he look so handsome in his Sunday best? He said he's sorry, you know the rest. You shouldn't really blame him, he's just a kid. Boys will be boys, don't you call him what he is. They got names for the ones who talk about.
All right. And this is the Peace and Justice program, and I have my next guest on the line, and I'm very pleased to introduce you to Margaret Swick. She is a founding member of the Concerned Citizens for Chico here in for Justice, Concerned Citizens for Justice, CC4J. She recently served on the mayor's Police Review Ad Hoc Committee. She is a past president of the League of Women Voters, Butte County, and served on the Juvenile Justice Commission for several years. She told me that she was an Air Force wife for 30 years while her husband served flying cargo around the world. Margaret was also a probation officer in Solano County for 10 years and has a Master's of Science in Human Resource Management. She has a passionate interest in multiple areas of law enforcement and particularly about how we treat the most vulnerable among us. She says there are better ways to treat people who have problems other than jails, weapons, and violence. Welcome, Margaret Swick, to the Peace and Justice Show. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm very, very delighted to have you with me today. There are some new laws going into effect here in California, and I was wondering if we could start off talking about those.
Okay, sure. The one that's very exciting to us is AB 1506, which will give the state attorney general the option of coming in to investigate officer-involved shootings. It doesn't go into effect until 2023, unfortunately, so therefore it won't be used on the Stephen Vest shooting in our city. There's complications with it. The police department or the district attorney has to request that investigation, unfortunately, which is worrisome, and there's no appropriation attached to it at this point. So, as you know, it will be costly to do those types of investigations. So hopefully, by the time it becomes is implemented in 2023, there'll be some funding attached.
Hmm. Is that the only one? That doesn't sound very hopeful at this point.
The only one in terms of investigating officer-involved shootings?
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, the big one for us this year in terms of our mission for concerned citizens is AB 392,
right,
involving the use of force.
And will that be applied in Chico?
Well, that's our hope. Across the state of California, numerous organizations are working to make sure that AB 392 is implemented in the manner in which it should be. We, as you know, our use of force policies for most of the cities in California is written by a for-profit criminal justice group called Lexipol. And to date, from the way I see our use of force policy, the full intent and tone of AB 392 has not been incorporated. But I would challenge our listening public to go to the Chico Police Department website, read our use of force policy, and compare it to the new state law.
And then communicate with the police, with the
well, and communicate
chief
with CC4J, because it really matters. AB 392 basically says that that the police department works to preserve and protect human life, and that is their top concern. Where does it say that in our use of force policy?
Right.
And we say that police officers can only use deadly force when there are no alternatives that would prevent death or serious bodily injury to either the officer or another person. How is that explained in our use of force policy?
Right.
you know, I served on the police review ad hoc review committee with high hopes that we would analyze our local use of force policy, because CC4J knows that it needs to take place. Unfortunately, we did not get the opportunity to do that. We did not go into our use of force policy line by line and see, does this reflect the values of Chico? We did have outstanding briefings from the police department, but we did not have analysis yet. So there's a lot of work yet to do on our use of force policy.
Yeah, I didn't see that as being a very cooperative committee in terms of being able to really get work done. But since we have such a short period of time together, I was very interested in the work that you have been doing personally. You've taken 32 courses over the summer from the National Association for Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. Is this something that you could tell us about, how other people could get involved with? Because it's important that this work is completed so that we don't have any more officer-involved shootings and abuse of force.
Well, as you know, there's a huge movement around the United States to make our police departments more transparent and open to the public. And, you know, it's only a basic need in a democracy. So we have this magnificent organization in the United States called National Association of Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. And their conference was digital this year, and I had the great honor to go to many of their courses. And I was thrilled with it, and I will continue to take everything I can. But their goal and our goal is civilian oversight of our police department and all of our law enforcement in Butte County. Increasingly, there's a citizen commission to take a look of how we're implementing use of force. Unfortunately, in Butte County, we have zero oversight.
Right.
And that's fearful. For instance, we just had the officer involved shooting in October, and to date, we haven't heard one word. I mean, what is that, 85 days later?
Of Stephen Vest in front of the Petco?
One report.
Yeah.
We don't know what was done to de-escalate the situation. We don't know anything about it. We have not seen camera footage. We have not read a report. And we know that Stephen Vest had behavioral health issues. Behavioral health team was not there. So if we have, at some point, civilian oversight over law enforcement, they will work with the police department to ensure that all effort is made to de-escalate.
Right. And lives can be saved in that way. Yeah, so let's talk about the Concerned Citizens for Justice commitment, who you are, your action plan, and your focus points in the 7 minutes we have left. Six.
Okay, thanks. Well, Concerned Citizens for Justice is just a bunch of residents here in Butte County who came together. We started after Desmond Phillips was shot, and we were heartbroken that a man that was mentally ill, had behavioral issues, that there was no effort made to de-escalate that and save his life. So we came together, we sat down at the table at Reme Hall with Vince Haney, and we began planning what we could do to make a difference so that this does not happen again. Unfortunately, within a short time, we had a second shooting to death, Tyler Rushing,
right,
and no efforts were made in that situation to de-escalate either. So we're just people who believe in fair and impartial policing. We think that transparency is absolutely essential. None of us are experts, but we care deeply about our city and about our country and about democratic principles. And it's been a challenge to come together for 3 years, all of us, none of us knowing each other, bringing various skills. We are a group of ministers, social workers, teachers, all, they're just us. And our group is open to anybody in the community who is also concerned about these matters. And our goal, our long-term goal, is to achieve oversight of the police department. We think it's in the best interest of our police department. We think that it enhances their professionalism. We care about community-oriented policing, the militarizing of our local police, and maybe most foremost is de-escalation, that our officers have the tools to de-escalate, that they have tools other than their gun.
Right. And so you have some, you have some things that you're asking people to sign on to with the action plan. Can you talk about that? How can people be involved?
Yes. We've asked community members who are our supporters to come on board and help us implement our action plan, which is moving toward mandating training and de-escalation and maintaining full transparency and accountability. So any of them could go to our website and contact us and come on board, and we look forward to it. It's going to take a strong coalition of like-minded citizens to move us into enlightened policing and into civilian oversight. It's an easy thing for most of us to just not even think about. Our police are doing a fine job, and in most cases, of course, they are. But we need a cultural change.
We do.
And we need Chico PD. We need the Sheriff's Department. We need the District Attorney. We need all the police agencies in Butte County to come on board with the enlightened changes going on in our country in policing.
Right. And, you know, we have just seen some outrageous footage of police who did not do their jobs in Washington, D.C. We know that there are influences from white supremacists on the Chico PD, and a lot of cultural things that give police impunity, and so there are really big concerns about how to have civilian oversight, how to be taken seriously. Can you please talk about, again, how do people get involved? Who would they write to if they have an issue that they're upset or outraged about? Besides supporting you and your work, how do you recommend just general citizens be working to their utmost right now during this fraught period?
Well, speak to our elected officials. Come forward and talk about why we're hiring more police officers when our downtown is in a state of crisis, right, and our students aren't in town. Why are we hiring more officers? Why have we created a violence suppression team? Why? And on it goes, whether we're going to talk about why is the Chico Police Department taking up the use of drones to surveil Chicoans.
Good point.
There's so many law enforcement issues happening, and I know that they're not the most pleasant issue for us to deal with. It's a real challenge, but they're issues we have to work on. None of these things I mentioned, whether it's drones or impounding vehicles or anything, move us toward enlightened policing. They're backwards. They're steps backward.
Yeah,
shooting Stephen Vest was a horrible and tragic step backwards for the city of Chico. And we've yet to hear from our city council or our district attorney or our police department about it.
And also with the issue of the homeless, the conservative city council ran on a ticket of moving the homeless out of where they were sheltering in place from COVID along greenways and along our creeks. And now there's a sit-lie ordinance, which is back in force, and there was going to be a revolving door. And it seems like it seems rather callous that more police are being brought on when mental health is being underfunded. Would you agree?
Well, yes. But, you know, Chris, I can't really speak to the homeless situation other than CC4J will be completely alert to any misuse of our police. But it's, in my mind, my personal, nothing but my personal opinion, not speaking for CC for J, it's unconscionable that our city has not come up with a campground that offers clean water, sanitation, and a safe place for people to be housed.
Mm.
I'm very, very sad about that. And then instead to hire more police, oh my, we're tone deaf.
Yes. Margaret Zwick, what is the email for, or the website for the CC4J?
Oh, good grief. I'm terrible about remembering things like that. It went out of my head. Google CC4J in Chico, Concerned Citizens for Justice Chico.
Yeah.
And it's there, and you can and put in your phone number, and we'll call you back.
All right. And I really want to thank you for your work. It's very, very critical right now. And I encourage you and others to be as involved as possible. It's extremely important. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so our next guest, our last guest of the Peace and Justice program is going to come up in a moment. I'm going to put on another song. And I do want to encourage all of you to be active participants in our democracy, just like Margaret Zwick. Follow her lead if you have time and you have the energy and you have the passion. Please get involved at whatever level you can. And I just want to remind you that the Congressional Switchboard is a way to reach any your congressman, Doug LaMalfa, who supported the coup this week, or Feinstein, Harris, 202-224-3121. That's a Congressional Switchboard. You can meet. You can find Mitch McConnell there. Anything you want to do there, you can. It would be good. This is the time to express outrage or concern, however you wish to do so. So our next guest is coming up, and here is a song, and thank you for listening. Hang on.
Gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Can't go on this way. Things gotta change around here. Say it loud, say it clear. Things gonna change around here. Fingers on the trigger around here. Fingers on the trigger around here. Bullets flying, mothers crying. We gotta change around here. Get it straight, be sure that you hear. Things gonna change around here. What good is freedom if we haven't learned to be free? What good is freedom if we haven't learned to be free? Gotta change around here.
All right. The incomparable Mavis Staples, Change. That's very much what is in the wind these days. And I have on the line with me Emmanuelle Saint. She is a grateful mother of five and regards herself as a heart activist with art capitalized, utilizing poetry, dance, and production as tools to enhance common unity, collaborators, and cultural education throughout local communities. She's an outreach organizer of GameAmp.org, a member of HUE Vision Productions, and has been an enthusiastic participant in the MLK Unity Group and the Beloved Community since arriving in Butte County in 2013. She is excited to be promoting this phenomenal collaborative vision that happens every January in our community, and I will let her go ahead and take it from there. Welcome, Emmanuelle Saint, to the KCFR Peace and Justice Show.
Thank you. I am so happy to be on this show, to be on KCFR. What a great program, what a great radio community radio station and this wonderful project with the MLK Unity and the beloved community. So I'm really honored to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And, you know, every year I've been attending the commemorations at the Trinity United Methodist Church, and I'm kind of sad about that we have to go online this year, but I'm so excited that it's happening. So tell us all about this year's observance of Dr. King's celebration.
Yes, we also were at the point of where, how do we spread this love and keep on sharing the beautiful energy that we always have, you know, in this wonderful community here in Butte County. And Chico, the city is always showing up. The community is always showing up. For this year's theme, the theme is restoration, reconciliation, and resilience. It came out of the whole, a lot of things that are happening, this earth-shaking events that we're experiencing this year, the uprising, the movement, the racial justice movements, the murder of George Floyd, and the passing of the Honorable John Lewis, the historic warrior for voting rights, who marched with Dr. King. So we've interwoven this current chaos, this current chaos is interwoven into our country's politics, and along with the pandemic, this movement is our resilience to rise, to restore, and to reconcile the grounds of the soul of our nation. And there's a restoration of Chico's Bethel AME Church bell tower, and that's a metaphor to our call and our personal and collective transformation, what's happening in this nation, this new... Our fabric is being pulled and torn, and we really need to, like, restore and sew and build together. So that's basically what this project is about, a number of us. The video director is Josh Edwards from JE Photography and Production. He's creating this masterful production with the help of a Butte College student, Maranatha Sink, that's my daughter. And we're creating this virtual program that's honoring the Machupa lands. It's unfolding phenomenal, gifted local artists, musicians, dancers, singing. Mm-hmm. And then our main speaker is Loretta Dickerson Smith, and she's just lifting up our spirits with the inspired vision. We have Allie Mathers Knight, who's going to be sharing a tech. Traditional ecological knowledge, you know, for the local ecological restoration. You know, we're all been going through so much here, especially Butte County. So it's just a lot of things, but it's just a phenomenal visual encapsulated of what we are as Butte County. Even though we're currently separated, all these artists, musicians, dancers, Haitian drum, African drum, hip-hop, spoken word, everything that you would expect from our annual events, from the plaza to the church. We're trying to bring this into one, to bring it to one, and the theme is restoration. We also have Alma Culture, who's going to talk about the creative approach she's using for children, educating children about African history. Just a collaborative of a whole bunch of producers and artists. Want to give thanks to Lana and the African American Cultural, mm-hmm. the African American Family Culture Center, North State Equity Fund. This is a whole plethora of ones and ones who are just helping us out and making this vision, this fabric. And big up to my Hue Vision women. I was doing a couple of visual pieces and quotes and quotes. So I know I said a lot, but we're hoping just to bring in the love. It's just a beautiful collaborative.
This sounds great.
The community coming together and saying, well, what do we do? And how do we make sure that we're all sharing in this? So the ones who want to know, when is this spectacular event happening?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to. When?
Yes, this is happening on January 18th, Monday, January 18th, between 2 and 4, and it's going to be aired on BCAC TV, which is Channel 11,
Additionally, we're going to have it on the Beloved Community Chico Facebook page and I believe MLK page. And so you can click on the link and it'll go straight to the YouTube page, and that will go bring you to BCACTV. So we want to give a big shout out to BCACTV Channel 11, because without their support, we would not be able to even broadcast this on such a level. So we're Instagramming, so big up to Skip. Check out the Beloved Community Chico page on Facebook and Instagram. And we have a whole bunch of youth who are helping us with the social media. And just, again, bringing out this message on restoration, resilience, healing, this cloth, this fabric of our nation. We just have to sew it. We just got to make it beautiful. We just have to get past this tough time. You know, I'm not much of a sewer, but, you know, I'm trying to go in that. This is our fabric.
It is our fabric.
Genuine quality.
Exactly. Yes, and it looks like it's also going to be on BCAC TV's YouTube channel. So if people don't have Facebook and they're not on Instagram, they'll still be able to participate if they have a cell phone and can get a YouTube. So, and then also, you believe it's going to be archived too, right?
Yes, I believe that should be archived. And I think BCAC will probably run it couple more times, but we should be having the archives. Again, it will be on the Beloved Community Chico Facebook, so check that out. Give that much love. Much love to Skip for just putting so much of so much energy in there. Again, for ones and ones for listening, it's Monday, January 18th, 2 to 4 p.m., as you said, on BCTV Channel 11 or BCTV YouTube channel. Or you can go to the Facebook, Beloved Community Chico Facebook, and I believe the MLK Unity Facebook will also have a link to that.
And this year is so important. It is the 40th annual celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a way that our community comes together in creating the Beloved Community. I want to thank you so much for being with me today, Emmanuel Saint, and thank you for your work in making this possible. And how can people find out more?
Well, they could definitely go to the Facebook, as I said, the Beloved Community Chico Facebook.
Okay.
At the MLK Unity. We're going to be sending out information on Instagram. Young ones who are on the IG, please check us out. Okay, don't forget BCC, Beloved Community Chico. We need your energy because you are our future. So everyone out there, be ready to sing. Lift every voice and sing. Wade in the water, what we usually do, that collectiveness. Be ready to comment. And be ready for next year. Be ready for 2021, because this is that year that we become one.
Thank you so much for your work. And peace to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, Emmanuel.
Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Sure. All right, it's the end of our show, and stay tuned for Playing Dead. They'll be in the house in a moment. I'm going to move right into the community calendar. Please wear your mask, do your distancing, and stay safe. Okay? Love you very much. Here we go. Oops. Get that cursor on there, girl.
Hey, listeners. Time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Megan Hammer. The Chico Art Center is now accepting art for the virtual exhibit, Birds of a Feather. This is jury-free and open call for artwork that celebrates birds as a symbol of freedom and community. There will be a Zoom artist talk event featuring a guest speaker for the exhibit. Applications of artwork are due by January 15th, and for more information or to apply, head over to the Chico Art Center webpage. The Oroville Branch Library is hosting a program called Babies Love Books every Thursday at 10:30 a.m. where parents and babies can enjoy connecting through rhymes, songs, and books during a program created especially for them. No sign-ups are necessary. It's presented by Butte County Library Literary Services at the Oroville Library. If you have an event that you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar.
Okay, and I guess we got done a little early, so that is good. I forgot to do my underwriter, so I want to thank so much all of you KZFR supporters and Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service to private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. And also want to thank Sonia Airy. She's an Allstate insurance agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and goals. For more information about protecting your life, home, vehicle, or boat, or to roll over your 401k, call Sonia at 345-2351. And stay tuned for Playing Dead. This is FM 90.1 KCFR Chico. It is listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. I'm going to put another song on so that they have time to get in here. Just one sec. And okay, so when the stars begin to fall, here we go. Maybe not. There we go.
Begin to fall.